Good morning. There was a revolution in the air on Wednesday's Liveline.
There's something so wrong with the system. It just makes me furious.
The system was housing. Jessica is a single person in her 50s looking for a home, and her story resonated with many.
I've been renting since the late 80s. I've been a freelance actor since the 80s. I was in my last place for 15 years. 10 of those years, I was a carer for my mother, who was blind. She died 3 years ago. A year later, I got a notice to quit. Trouble-free tenancy. Got on well with the landlord. He wanted to refurbish. So that was it. And COVID intervened. And obviously, it was, you know, there was a long lead-in before I had to leave. I finally had to leave last September. I've been couch surfing ever since. There's nowhere to go. And I mean there's nowhere to go. I have an excellent reference from the landlord. Haven't had an opportunity to show it to anybody in 2 years because there's just simply nowhere to rent. Compounded probably by the fact that I'm a freelance artist, I'm single, I have no children. I've been on the housing list for 10 years, nowhere near the top of it. So I have been left couch surfing for a year, basically, only for the fact that I have friends, I'd be in homeless accommodation. And like most people my age, I'm in my 50s now, like most people my age, you know, there's no family home, my parents are gone, there's just nowhere to go. There's nowhere to go to kind of say, okay, well, I'm not really homeless. I can go back to home when something's really bad. And I'm kind of, I really want to challenge, and I realize this is, I think that the thing is, I realize that this is my life. If I found a place to rent tomorrow, like anybody else, it's not the end of it. I'm only in my 50s now. I'm heading into old age with this. And so is everybody who, this is the rental market. Even people listening now, they're in their 20s and 30s, that, this has nothing to do with me. This is heading down the track for you too, unless something changes.
And when Paula phoned in, well, she was furious.
I am actually sick and tired of listening to a conversation about housing almost my whole life. And all of this conversation revolves around young people. And it assumes that first-time buyers are in their 20s. And what Jessica has done is that she has pointed out that there's a whole generation of people who have been absolutely failed by a completely failed, broken system. And she has nothing to be ashamed of. None of us who haven't been able to afford to get a mortgage, none of us have anything to be ashamed of. Mm. The people who should be ashamed are the people who make a living keeping a broken system on the road. They are bankers. They are politicians. Many of those politicians are themselves landlords. So yep. We have a system which is crazy because the conflicting interests keep the system broken on behalf of the people who actually need the houses. And what we actually need here is a movement. We need to stop being silent, and we need to speak out, and we need to name the problem.
It was system change Paula wanted, not pity or charity, leading to Damien getting something of a schooling.
Yes. Isn't that part of the problem actually now, coincidentally, that so many so-called accidental landlords are selling up, which is actually creating this problem that you find yourself in?
Well, do you know
No, stop there.
Okay, Paula, No, I'm just putting the question out. That argument is made.
Yeah, well, forget about that. Let's stop looking after the landlords. We need to start looking after the citizens. Well, this is not a market. You're speaking the language of the market there, and you're basically saying that the providers in Damien, this is the question that you have to answer. You, Damien, would you like to have been living in rented accommodation for 25 years?
Absolutely not.
Now, stop right there. Everybody who's part of the system, the people who provide the money, the people in the councils, the people who make the policies, the politicians, everybody needs to sit and in silence ask themselves that question. Would I be prepared to live in rented accommodation for a quarter of a century? Would that feel like a good model of life?
No, if
the answer to that is no, then we need to stop talking about the participants in the system and talk about the system itself.
And Paula wasn't stopping there.
When my mother and father got married in the early 1960s, they lived on a factory worker's wage, one wage. They rented a tenement, a flat where I was born. We moved into a county council house, which they rented and then bought. And out of that, they bought their final home. And they were able to do that by the time they were younger than me.
Yeah.
And that is a system that worked.
Yes.
And what we need to do is to look at the fact that we have made a system that doesn't work. It is broken from the bottom up, and it needs to be reinvented from the bottom up. And saying that somehow the solution is providers, like landlords, as if they were providing sandwiches or cars. Yes. This is, as Jessica quite rightly said, this is a human right. The United Nations, back in the 60s, said that housing was human right, and almost every country that signed up to that declaration has failed to provide that human right because they subsequently signed up to neoliberal economics that said, let the market provide.
Well, as the programme progressed, more and more people in middle age and renting phoned in. Nuala is in her 60s and talked to Damien from a bus.
Where are you going to?
I'm going from Mullingar to Dublin because I now live in Mullingar because I could not afford anywhere to rent in Dublin. And I mean anywhere. I was at one stage just living in a hotel. That was the only place that I could find somewhere to live. I went over to England for a little while to save my sister. She moved to America and I came back to Ireland then because this is where I work, obviously. But I couldn't find anywhere. And then I was looking up on the internet and I saw this place in Mullingar and I went, to hell with it. I can live down there. There's a bus every hour. You know, it's expensive to travel up and down, but at least I've got a roof over my head that I can afford to rent.
Mm.
But I could find nothing in Dublin. I do not know one solitary single person in the whole of Mullingar. So during the whole lockdown, I had nowhere to talk to. I couldn't go out for a walk with anybody. I was so isolated. So it really played a huge effect on my mental health. The fact that even when, you know, when the things loosened up a bit and you could meet with somebody outside for a coffee or something, I had nobody to talk to because everybody that I know is in Dublin because that's where I work and that's where I socialise. That's where I'm heading to now tonight to go out to meet a friend. I'm in my 60s now. When I was looking for somewhere to live, I was ringing up all these, you know, house shares. And, you know, I'd go around and people would be really nice and then they'd say, oh, no, we got somebody else. Because nobody wants an L1 living in their house because they think, oh, gee, we're going to have her for the rest of their life. These are all young people, you know, starting out in their careers that managed to get an apartment or get a house. And obviously they have to rent out rooms to make their mortgage, you know, unless they have a partner. And they don't want an L1 living in the house with them.
PJ was in a somewhat similar situation.
I just recently turned 50. And for people like me, we've kind of become forgotten. And I was telling you, research, I was renting up to about 6-7 years ago. And like that previous girl, I was able to afford maybe 700 or 800 euros a month. I have a public sector job. I suppose my close friends would not be surprised at what I'm saying. But I guess a lot of my acquaintances probably would be shocked. They'd look at me and they'd say, sir, he couldn't be in such a situation. And only for my mother, who's now 70, and her goodwill, I would actually be homeless. And I'm 30 years working the same job, 50 years of age, earning about 40 to 45,000 a year. But because of the price of rent, I've three daughters now who are almost growing up, and I've really had, I suppose, despite what people said, nothing but shame has kind of followed me around. Because I see my daughters who I'm so proud of, but when you haven't got your own door to shut, when everybody leaves in the evening time, it's a very, very lonely place. And loads of other people my age group were kind of forgotten about. Even one of the girls was mentioning sharing. If you turn up at a door sharing, you do get the look straight away. You know, I'm going to talk for 10 minutes. They're going to take on my details. But they don't want you. I don't drink. And people are, if you're sharing with people who are even having a bit of crack and a bit of fun or having a good night out, that's all difficult. Stuff you could do, but they won't take you on.
And all of this stress had led to serious anxiety and a panic attack.
Only last year, something I probably would have rolled my eyes at, I got a panic attack. And it was from the constant chipping away at, yeah, I'm probably going to get something. Yeah, I'm probably going to get somewhere. And, you know, as I said, I had three daughters. I have to have somewhere maybe just to bring them even for a Sunday lunch and that we can have a bit of a chat. But when you're, if you had to share, or even with your mother, it's difficult to do that. But like I said to you, I got a panic attack. I probably poured my heart out, you know, a bit too much.
No, you're
something
right.
I thought I was dying with a heart attack or something. And it, so that's what it has done to me.
And the common thread throughout all of these calls was being single in middle age. Back to Jessica.
Everybody just thinks of people in couples. Yes, of course. Everything is rent. Everything is priced as if you're a couple. Even one-bedroom places are priced as if there are two people paying 600 or 700 euro. Priced as if everybody comes in a pair, like Noah's Ark. Well, they don't. You don't think in those terms. You shouldn't be hooking up with somebody or thinking, God, now if I just had somebody, now we could move in together and then it'd be fine. That's not a relationship. Two things are totally separate.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I want a room. I want a roof over my head. I want a home. I want to live in peace.
But to be able to go and get romantically involved with somebody, is obviously made that more a little bit more difficult for obvious reasons.
Of course it's made more difficult.
Exactly.
All I can think about is where am I going to go in February? I don't have the energy to go out looking for a relationship at this point. You know what I mean? Everything, it takes all your energy. And what PJ said about having panic attacks that they never had before, I totally relate to that. I'm not an anxious person. I'm good. I've always been very good at coping. But I mean, I have, since this has happened, and even though I can rationalize it and I have good support system with friends and stuff, I have leaping anxiety that I never had before. It plays havoc with your mental health.
And that point was underscored by the very final call that came in. This is Sandra, who's in her early 50s.
I'm living in a shed with electricity but no running water.
A shed?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because I can't afford rent.
But are you living like in someone's garden?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, it's a very difficult situation. And this country does not take into account people who are single, who like, it's just crazy. It's a bad situation. This country is not fulfilling its care of duty for people. It's not good. And it's very hard to talk about because there's so much shame involved in it. And you feel so dispossessed.
Sandra from Wednesday's Liveline. A powerful programme. Back in a bit. Welcome back. On A Word in Edgeways, Supermarket Love from Jan Brereton.
All life is here. A couple debates whether they should get this or that. One of them taking the reins on quality, menu planning and the budget. The other looks miserable, like they'd rather be anywhere but here. An elderly man buys a ready meal for one, a newspaper and a tin of cat food. Parents push their little ones in the trolley, exclaiming loudly and slowly every time they deposit an item into the shopping cart. Apple, carrots, toilet roll. Recently, I met a woman I know well enough. We always stop and chat and share snapshots of our lives with each other. We cover holidays, husbands, kids, work, weather. Out of the blue, she announced, "I lost my mum." I took a deep breath and tilted my head. I could feel myself welling up. "I am so, so sorry to hear this. Was she unwell?" I asked. I too have blurted out big life events to passing acquaintances in the supermarket. I've embraced, I've held and been held when sharing the passing of a parent, a brother, a beloved friend. I've wept in the cereal aisle while the traffic of trolleys and shoppers buzzed around me. She stared at me. I lost her. Oh God, no, she's grand. She was just down around the frozen food the last time I saw her. I better go and find her. Bye.
From A Word in Edgeways. And yesterday, Ryan spoke to Richard Osman, best-selling author of The Thursday Murder Club.
Yeah, this is like the 18, but the A stands for arthritis.
It's set in a retirement village. And this allowed Osman to have a lot of fun with lazy stereotypes around ageing.
When people get older, we start to neglect them slightly in our culture. You know, we start to overlook them. And that's just at the time when they've got the most experience. Yeah, you know, they can you know, we'll happily sit down with our grandparents and ask for advice. But culturally, as a society, the older people would just know, oh, no, well, we'll shut you away somewhere. Yeah. Which, first of all, was casting them as detectives. I mean, it's two things. Firstly, they've got incredible experience, so they can solve stuff. But secondly, everyone thinks they're harmless and everyone overlooks them, so they can go anywhere. They can sort of open any door. And for detectives to be considered completely harmless, but also to be incredibly clever, is a really, really
a great
useful
combination.
Thing as a writer. Yeah, yeah.
Now, why is that, I wonder? That we kind of see people hitting a certain age and we decide, societally almost, well, whatever they did before this point is now... like negated.
Well, here's, you know, this is the truth, a terrible truth, but advertisers don't really advertise to people over 60 because people over 60 already know what they like and they know what they want to buy. You can't, whereas 25 year olds, all the money in the world is spent, is thrown at them because 25 year olds change their minds every 5 seconds.
Yeah.
You know, so that's advertising. So the whole of our culture is based on what people are paying to put on television. And so, yeah, older people tend to get left out of it a little bit.
But when you're interacting with your own parents, for example, petulant child, you can hear the eye rolling.
We were down seeing my mum last weekend.
Yeah.
And, you know, I turn into a teenager, right? So I can
see. In what way?
Just in that, you know, when it's there's something about one's own parent where you start, you know, everything they say, you have to slightly disagree, you have to slightly nitpick, you have to go, well, not, God. Or, you know, if they can't get the Sky Plus to work, you're like, oh, God, it's really easy. And you think, I don't speak to anybody else like this. I just don't.
What
and
is that?
What it's love. So right. Yeah, it's love, for sure.
It's experience.
But it's someone who really, really, really knows you. And of course, we all, when we leave home, we slightly reinvent ourselves.
Yes.
Usually not deliberately, but there's something where we go, actually, this is who I am as an adult. This is who I am in the real world. And when you go back home, firstly, you're not treated in that way. But secondly, that parent sort of knows a bit of it is a lie. Yeah. You know, they look into your soul. And you think, don't look into my soul.
It's too much.
That's
too much knowledge.
Last thing I want. Yeah.
Ooh, very true. Richard Osman with Ryan. And autographing her first book at 82 is Anne Ingle. Her memoir is called Open Hearted, and she is a humdinger of a woman on all kinds of levels. The book is a love letter of sorts to her husband Peter, who died by suicide 41 years ago today. And it's also a love letter to her eight children, including writer Roisin Ingle. She started, though, by talking to Ray about meeting Peter and being immediately smitten.
You met him by chance when you were 20 or thereabouts.
Yes, I was 20 at the time.
And it was love at first sight.
Well, it was. I know that sounds terribly, you know, cliched and everything, but it was love at first sight because he stepped out of the car with his mop of blonde curly hair. And then when he opened his mouth, the Irish accent did a lot as well. The sparkling blue eyes, the tan. Well, what more could a woman want? He was a looker and he was a singer and he was a charmer. He had that kind of charisma, you know. In his heyday, he could silence a whole public house by just opening his mouth and singing.
They married in a matter of months. However, as their marriage progressed, it became clear that Peter was struggling with mental health issues.
He started to see things that weren't there. Do you know, there was one... Well, it started on this dramatic, it's traumatic and dramatic day. When I went out of the room to make some tea, he said he had a headache or something. I came back in and he was standing at a window. We lived in Sandymount Green and we had a big window overlooking the green. And he was standing there and he said to me, look at all the people in the green. He said, sun is shining and they're all so happy and isn't it lovely? And I just looked over his shoulder and there was nobody in the green and it was starting to rain, you know what I mean? So I got, you can imagine, can you imagine that?
No,
rain?
No.
You know,
your
heart sinks. This couldn't be right, you know. And
He was eventually diagnosed with schizophrenia, but his delusions got worse and worse.
Like he said, I'm being eaten inside by the devil.
That's what he said.
And then the religious delusions increased. I'm Jesus Christ. He said, I must die to save the world. You and the children will come with me.
Yeah. Can you imagine that happening, Ray?
I know it's difficult to go back there, but like, what were you thinking? And of course you had all these children as well. And that's the other thing, which I had to keep reminding myself reading the book.
Yes. There were seven of them upstairs and he is saying this to me. And I mean, I was terrified, but at the same time, I knew I had to keep my head. I had to be the strong one there. Mm. And I'd found already as I started on his sickness that it's better to kind of agree with somebody. If somebody believes something very strongly, do you know, it's really hard to say, oh, no, that's a load of rubbish. No, that wasn't what I did. I said, oh, yes, right, right. I was trying to play for time. And luckily enough, two friends called and we managed to get things under control. And
because he had thrown himself at the fireplace.
Yes, he threw himself at the fireplace. His head was bleeding. And then he kind of calmed down and we had a huge coffee table that was once our dining room table, and Peter had cut it down to make a coffee table, so it was huge. And we lifted that up and put it on top of him, and he was under the table, and we sat on top of it until he calmed down.
That's nearly comical, isn't it?
It is. It was really, really a strange thing. And it left me with this man who was only not the man I'd married, but he was another person. But of course, I loved him. I loved him even more in a way because he was so dependent on me.
Now, Peter was in and out of various mental health facilities, but it was not to be.
And Anne, were you and any of them in any way prepared for what happened? In that it was telegraphed in a way?
No, well, I wasn't really prepared this time when it actually happened because he was doing so well. Mm. You see, I imagined that we were going to go just up and up and he would get better and better. But I underestimated him and his need to go.
Yeah.
And that's nothing I could do.
You see, I know this is it's very difficult. It's this thing about, you know, are there things that are worse than death?
Yeah.
Isn't that a big question?
It is a big question. It's a big question. And maybe if I'd have been in his shoes, you know, it's a hard one.
Yeah, it is a difficult.
But he had a, you know, life was good. The children were good, and I was hoping against hope. Yeah. So, really, when it did happen in the end that morning, it was a shock to me. It was a terrible, terrible shock. Of course, it would be for anybody. But I mean, I didn't really anticipate that. I really, really didn't.
And in your pink box, you've kept his note. Well, it wasn't a note because he wrote it on the Ladybird book.
He led, and that's why. He said in it there, I love you the best, Anne, and that's why I dedicated the book to him, to Peter, to the man who loved me the best.
Best, yeah.
You see.
I loved you the best. Mm-hmm. I can't stick it anymore. Forgive me. God bless you and the children.
That's what he said, yeah.
Anne Ingle on the death of her husband, Peter. And it's worth saying the full title of her memoir. It's Open-Hearted 80 Years of Love, Loss, Laughter and Letting Go. Because while she didn't shy away from the darkness and the pain, the interview with Ray was a great listen and a lot of fun.
You went through really tough times, and the book isn't like that, though. It's a very uplifting, hopeful book.
Yes, I hoped you were going to say that because I was getting worried that people were going to think that it was all sadness.
No.
I told my story about Peter and the sadness of what happened to us. But at the same time, in between that, I've told about what happened to me since.
Yes.
And all the uplifting things and all the wonderful things. I mean, I've had a wonderful life,
you
know? But
even the fact that you're sitting here talking to me at 82.
I know.
You're talking to your book.
I know. You see, 82, isn't it? You see, I was thinking on the way coming here.
Okay.
82, but I wasn't always 82. Do you see what I mean?
Yes.
I wasn't always 82, and I've had all that life experience, and I'm not on my own. There's so many people out there, older people, and they've all got stories. Mm. So if people just take the time to listen to us, you know, we are important people, you know.
And the other thing is, like, nobody should be allowed to write a memoir until they're in their 80s. I think
that's true. You know, these people doing that at 25 is ridiculous.
They've gone through Love Island and then they've a memoir out for Christmas. Go take a hike.
Fair point. Now, spare a thought for Claire Byrne, who was trying valiantly to get to grips with Einstein's theory of relativity with a little help from Dr. Shane Bergen of UCD.
I was looking up simple explanations this morning for the theory of relativity, and there were two fellas sitting on a train. I had to watch that for a while.
Yeah.
Then I had to watch Einstein up on a space rocket. And it was a really good explanation, but still by the end of it, I was questioning whether I had fully grasped what he had managed to prove.
But you know what, though? I think that's wonderful because It's when science or, like music or philosophy or literature just pulls you in, and it's that you're like, I'm trying to think about this. I'm trying to make sense of it. Yes, what he was trying to do was understand the attraction between two objects as gravity as we'd know it. And he was overturning Newton's work, which had dominated from the 17th century. So he was bringing it on another level. And he said that the fabric of space and time is curved. This was his thing. He imagined the universe to be like a very taut bedsheet where all of the heavy objects are placed on it and cause a deformation in the bedsheet. And that is what pulls things towards it. That is what explains gravity. So whilst, of course, we are attracted to massive objects like the sun or the earth, we are, of course, all attracted to one another gravitationally as well. We all pull on one another in a very, very gentle way.
The universe as a pulled bedsheet. Thank you, Dr. Shane Bergen of UCD with Clare. Now, as you're sipping your coffee this morning, you might be wondering, golly, where has Michael Stipe been? Turns out the REM singer was over chatting to Dave Fanning on Sunday about his latest project, Our Interference Times, a dense, intense book of images and photographs with Generation X writer Douglas Copeland.
It's me looking at the way that we look at the world before the advent of digital technology and how much that changed, how much digital technology changed the way I took photographs and the way I look at things.
But while visual art is integral to who Stipe is, Dave wanted to know about the music and REM, and in particular, taking a hiatus from touring and then embarking on the Monster Tour, which included playing Slane.
Did you feel that Monster had to be a kind of a tough album? Because if you're going to come out and tour, the songs on the previous tour, on the previous albums, Out of Time and Automatic for the People, were probably too soft to be playing in front of 50,000 people.
That's correct. And so we felt like we needed to write something that was harder. And we wrote a quote unquote rock album. And it has nothing to do with rock. It's more, it's much more kind of, it owes a lot to glam rock and to pop music. It's really very, very pop. But it's presenting the work through these big sounds and a lot of sound effects. And even the vocal is sound effecty. You know, it was very inspired, truthfully, by U2 and by Achtung Baby, and by them deciding not to take themselves so seriously. I'm a huge fan, and of course we've been friends since the mid 80s, great friends, but when they put out Achtung Baby, I was like, whoa, hang on a second, this is really, really advanced and we need to respond. And so Monster was our response to U2 being as brilliant as they were with that record and with pop.
And at the age of 61, and with frankly nothing to prove, just listen to how Michael Stipe answers this question.
Do you think you're a good pop star, or do you think you're a good rock star?
I think I was a great pop star, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
But as
I said earlier, I did everything that I could to be as great as I could, and I gave everything that I had. And I often say this, you know, I'm very proud of the triumphs. I'm also very proud of the failures and the horrible mistakes and the embarrassing fall on your face moments over the course of 32 years. If that had not happened, and I'm looking back right now, I'm just doing some research looking at some of David Bowie's least remembered moments as a public figure and as a writer. And the guy was just trying. He was doing everything. He was experimenting. He fell on his face a few times. So did I. You know, I'm okay with that.
He fell.
To answer your question, yes, I think I was a very good pop star.
A very good pop star, and he gives good gossip. Courtney Cox, Monica from Friends, was the receptionist for his booking agent and worked for REM for a while. Now, the two of them are very good friends, hence this confession.
Courtney used to, her job when REM would come to New York and we would stay for weeks at a time, her job was to cook me vegetarian food. And so she told me years and years later that she did the best that she possibly could, but that sometimes it wasn't completely vegetarian. I was like, she wanted my forgiveness. And I was like, Courtney, that was 1984 or 1985, whenever. I don't care. It's okay. I survived. We're all here to tell the tale. It's fine.
Heat up there, Michael. Ah, it's just a fleshy bit of cauliflower. Back in a bit. Welcome back. New Zealand megastar singer Lorde. And we'll never be. the very one. And she spoke to Ray on Tuesday about her new album. At least that was her plan. Darcy, on the other hand...
I'm looking at your name, if you don't mind. You're Ella Maria Lanny Yellick O'Connor.
Oh, yeah.
Now, that's Irish there, O'Connor.
Good Irish name.
Yeah. So what's the story?
Well, my father's Irish. My father's family immigrated. His grandfather immigrated to New Zealand. We are very much an Irish family. I horribly am yet to probably visit Ireland and make that connection, but it was sort of it was on my list right before the pandemic happened. So I'm hoping I have a do over.
Here's the thing you could do, right? We have this competition called the Rules of Tralee, where...
Oh my God, I know about the Rules of Tralee. I know all about it. Yes. We have this in New Zealand also.
Yeah. So you're eligible to enter, Lord.
Oh my gosh, imagine if I entered the Rose of Tralee.
Now listen, I don't know what your party piece is going to be. I can't imagine what your party piece is going to be, but it could be this.
Big tune.
Yeah. Isn't that a song you used to sing as a child, is it? Or like... read that somewhere.
Yeah. I used to sing that at school and really enjoyed it. Yeah. Now my mind's running wild about the Rose of Tralee.
that will be very exciting. Lord in the Dome with Thahi. We shall see. And this week saw more and more restrictions being lifted, and we had the return of choirs. Brian O'Connell visited the Harmania Indie Choir in Waterford.
Did they make you sing, Brian?
Well, I can tell you, I'd say people have suffered enough really, Claire, than to have to listen to me singing.
Wise, that's wise.
Brian doing the decent thing. Now, the choir is led by Rosine McGrath, and for members, just to stand beside people and sing can be a tonic.
I am Nicole. It's absolutely great to be back.
And for you, why do you come to choir?
So I originally started coming to choir because I'm a music teacher myself, and I wanted to be back in the student role. I wanted to be learning again, and I suppose I come to choir for a different reason now. Still that same reason, but I recently had a baby back in February, and I had quite a sick pregnancy the whole way through, and now I kind of, I suppose, panic about my health. I have a fear of being sick now because I was so sick, and I am working on it, but I find that one of my therapies now is actually singing. I find that kind of singing and doing some of the techniques that Roisin taught us here in choir very helpful and calming and soothing, and it's like, it is a proven thing that people who sing in choirs together can go on to the same heartbeat rhythm and everything. Like, I don't think of anything outside of choir. Like, whatever is going on in the outside world doesn't exist when I'm inside in the four walls here.
Oh, that is beautiful. There might be something in my eye. And our need to connect and be heard and seen in all our mess and humanity is vital to all of us. Psychologist Dr. Maureen Gaffney joined Brendan to talk about her new book, Your One Wild and Precious Life. And she kicked off with middle age, yes, looking in the rear view mirror with her eye on the horizon. So time for an audit to see how we're faring. Are you getting your needs met? And there are three biggies. First up,
the need for closeness. And that takes, you know, several forms. They, you need one person who's your number one in your life, someone that you can turn to when you need to, someone who's your safe haven. So that if you've had a rotten day or if you've had a setback or something, or if you've had great news, that's the person you want to ring immediately. That's the person that you hope, if things are not going well, will comfort you and reassure you and buck you up. And, you know, like you know, if you had a good mother, your mother would say, like, you know, put your shoulders back and go out there and you'll be grand, you know. Mm. And I think that's kind of what we want all throughout life.
Second, we have autonomy.
Most people think of autonomy as being sort of coolly self-sufficient, and that's not what autonomy means. What autonomy means is the sense that you can exercise reasonable control over the way your life is going.
Yeah.
That you can live your life in a way that is true to yourself. You know, there's nothing as depressing as feeling that you can't be who you really are with the people in your life in one way or the other, that you have this kind of false self that you have to keep living up to. And then, you know, we have our own enemies within. You know, we're plagued with things like, you know, self-criticism and perfectionism and self-doubt. And, you know, an awful lot of people like do a very good job of covering all that up, you know, and they think like that's just me. And so it's so reassuring when you can let it out and then discover the fantastic news that someone still likes you. You know, someone doesn't think like you're a pathetic, sad case, you know.
Oh, you'd like to think so. And finally,
and the third is the need for competence, the need to feel that you can manage things. If you watch a 2-year-old, you know, they're the three things that, you know, would say preoccupied a 2-year-old boy. You know, I'll say boy to distinguish him from talking about mothers then, you know, that like they want to feel like that, you know, when they're putting a brick pile together, you know, and it keeps falling down, you know, that someone is there to sort of give them a helping hand. They want to feel that when they made the brick tower, that someone is going to say, fantastic, like, you're such a great boy, you know, and that kind of stuff, you know. And we never, like, we just get more sophisticated about the way we make these bids for connection to people as we get older. You know, we do something and then we find ourselves trying to catch someone's eye and think like, did that land, you know? So, you know, that's how we are, you know?
It's like she's in your head. Dr. Maureen Gaffney totting up the emotional capital with Brendan. And connection came up again when writer Mark O'Halloran spoke to Ryan. Having previously worked with Lenny Abrahamson on Adam and Paul, they're back together working on the adaptation of Sally Rooney's novel Conversations with Friends, which was, it turned out, a handy segue into O'Halloran's own play, also involving conversations. And this.
It opens with a man looking for his underpants, as all great plays should.
Goes without saying. Now, the play is called Conversations After Sex, and as Ryan noted, the after bit here is crucial.
It's a year in the life of a woman who has suffered a loss. Her partner dies and she finds herself to be very isolated in life. She has cared for her father when he was ill and then for her partner when he was suffering a debilitating mental health episodes. Mm-hmm. And she finds herself isolated, and the only way she can connect with people is through dating apps, through meeting people anonymously in bars and hooking up and having anonymous sexual encounters with people. And it's over the year that she's getting over but she's dealing with her grief. And it's about people who are disconnected from the world, who are trying to find intimacy with each other, and they're complete strangers. And it literally is, after the sexual encounters she has with people, these are just the conversations that happen. There's 28 of them. She meets people, you know, twice and three times and four times over the year. And slowly she begins to put herself back together after losing her partner.
And is the the sex the outlet for her to yep. grieve or mourn in a very physical...
I think sex is just a need for her to find physical intimacy with people. The sexual energy within her takes up space where she might have been thinking about her loss or where she might have been thinking about the pain that she's going through. And she allows herself to find a new adventure, to find yeah. a new partner, the freshness of all of that helps her to forget a little bit. And then after the sexual act, it all comes flooding back and she has these very open, honest conversations with men that she doesn't know.
And while, yes, there is sex, that's not really what this is about.
I often think that, like, for years, Irish dramatists or maybe Irish society in general was obsessed with sex and the sexual act was the dramatic thing in people's lives.
Yes.
But actually, it's the need to connect with people is the dramatic thing in our lives. The need to converse with people or the need to find some connection or to still the loneliness that people are going through. That's the drama, I find. Yeah. Or the loss of people, death and loneliness and feelings of failure and inadequacy and blah. They're the drama things.
They're there. And do you think that the post-coital conversation has a stronger strain of gravitas than maybe the pre?
I think they're funny conversations, actually. Sometimes, you know, they can be talking about the sexual act and it mightn't have been the greatest sexual act that has ever happened in the whole world.
Yes.
And so they talk about those kind of things as well.
Analysis, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Post-match analysis, exactly. And actually, the play is a comedy and it's quite funny. I mean, I think that nowadays, people who are single, adults who are single, do a lot of navigating dating sites and navigating. And I think that maybe they'll be familiar with some of the scenarios.
I have no doubt.
That are mapped out in the play.
Oh, sounds very intriguing indeed. The play is called Conversations After Sex and it's on as part of the Dublin Theatre Festival. But just before Mark O'Halloran left, he gave us this lesson in love.
What has the cat done to your life?
The cat... She saved my life.
What's your cat's name?
My cat's name is Delia, after Delia Murphy.
Oh, really?
Of course.
Singer extraordinaire. Yeah.
I got her during the what we won't mention, the lockdown.
The thing, yeah.
And I live alone, so there was a kind of a loneliness thing going on. Okay. And people were saying, get a dog. And I find dogs are so needy. Like, if I'm going to be in a relationship with an animal, I want to be the needy one. And I felt there was a lot of work with the dog. So someone on Twitter said, look, I have kittens. I'll drive up to Dublin and I'll give you a kitten. And she gave me this kitten. And this little girl entered my life, this little kitten. And she's just been wonderful.
Delia. Do you talk to Delia? I mean, would you talk out loud to her?
Oh, yes. Yes, yes. Great. I spend most of the day wandering around my flat going, who's the best girl? Are you the best girl? You are the best girl. The best girl. If you taped from the conversation, that's what gets said about 5 million times a day. But actually, it does this thing for you, which is like if you're living alone and there's an isolation thing going on, you're in your own head going, hey, what'll I do today? I'll have a sandwich. Will I have a sandwich? Whereas with there's a cat in the house, you're actually out of your brain staring at her saying, who's the best girl? And it actually is very healthy for you, I think.
Best pitch ever to take a cat into your home.
It has been one of the greatest things I've ever done.
After all of the great things we've been discussing.
And she's cranky as hell.
Really?
And, yeah. And moody. And sometimes she disappears for a whole 24 hours and then comes back.
It sounds like a desperate relationship that you're clearly enjoying.
But the cuddles. The cuddles, right?
Mark O'Halloran, who knew?
Well, that is it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening. And this goes out to the spectacularly named Delia Murphy and Cats in Kitchens Everywhere.
Come sing ye bell and bow, unto me pay attention. Don't ever fall in love, for 'tis the devil's own invention. Once